Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The following announcement was issued early this morning by the United States Army Air Corps, European Theater of Operations, and the Air Ministry. United States Army Air Force's Flying Fortresses, B-17s, escorted by Royal Air Force, Dominion, and Allied fighters, made a high-altitude attack upon the railway marshaling yards at Rouen late yesterday afternoon. The attack was successful, all fortresses releasing their entire bomb loads on the target. Enemy pursuit planes were encountered, and one was shot down by a gunner of a flying fortress. Brigadier General Ira C. Eaker, commanding General United States Army Air Force Bomber Command, led the attack in a fortress. Meanwhile, other escorted fortresses were conducting diversional operations. All of the fortresses returned safely. Two escorting fighters are missing.
Welcome to the Mighty Eighth podcast with me, Johan Tasker, and military historian Mike Peters. Season 1, The Bomb Run. You've just heard the official joint statement by the US and UK governments following the first American-led bombing mission over occupied Europe during World War II. And you join us in the very place those B-17 bombers took to the skies 80 years ago on August 17th, 1942, for that very first mission. We're standing in the middle of what was runway number one, the main runway at Grafton Underwood Airfield in Northamptonshire, eastern England. Those flying fortresses belong to the 97th Bomb Group of the United States 8th Army Air Force, what was to become the greatest air armada in history. And in this podcast series, we'll be telling the story of the Mighty Eighth, discovering with you the people, the planes, and the places who sacrificed so much in the fight for freedom. Mike, in many ways, this is hallowed ground, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, this is Station 106, so this is one of the very first airfields given over by the UK government to the US Army Air Force, newly formed as it was. And when Ira Eaker and his recce group arrive here in the February of 1942, this is one of the first sites they come to. Although it's not really finished, and as you know, the nickname for the place given by the first of the 3,000 Americans who came here was Grafton Under Mud. But it does see a procession of the early units of the US Army Air Force arriving in UK via Iceland or however they've got here, operating out of here, then going somewhere else until it's really fully established. But it's quite a thing now to be stood here almost to the hour of the first raid on the spot in the middle of the main runway.
Yeah, it's quite incredible, isn't it? And although the planes have long gone and the runway here has been planted with trees, you don't have to look very far at all to see traces of the Mighty Eighth. And the village, when we came through it, when we drove through it, the village of Grafton Underwood, it's much the same as it was 80 years ago. A handful of thatched limestone cottages. And amid the trees where we are now, about half a mile from the main village, is this stone memorial dedicated to those airmen, those aircrew who flew from here. It's about 8 foot tall, a black and pink granite obelisk standing on a plinth by the side of the Geddington Road. And if we look behind the obelisk, we can see a small garden of remembrance with some neatly trimmed bushes and two flagpoles, one American flying the Stars and Stripes, and one British flying the Union flag. Mike, if we read the words engraved in gold on this monument, they tell us the first and last bombs dropped by the 8th Air Force were from airplanes flying from Grafton Underwood.
Although this significant memorial is really to the 384th Heavy Bomb Group, it does mark a significant airfield that stands out in amongst the whole narrative and chronologic timeline of the 8th Air Force in England.
And why Grafton Underwood then? Why would they build an airfield here?
Well, all of the airfields that are given over initially in 1942 to the US Army Air Force are RAF. They're built for the RAF. And this one was work on it here started in 1941 and was still ongoing in 42. And they're built to bomb Germany, which is great. You think, oh, that's pretty logical. But the pre-war doctrine before Britain started rearming was that France would still be in the fight, Belgium would still be in the fight, and the Netherlands would still be in the fight. So we would be bombing from the east side of England into Germany, not bombing into what would become occupied Europe. So that was the logic. And when Eaker and his guys first get here, it's okay, you can have these airfields, these are available. And it's interesting that when Ira Eaker and his recce group start to move around the country, they rapidly realise that the RAF are deeply embedded in Lincolnshire and Bomber County and Northamptonshire and all this area. And he wants to keep his air traffic away from RAF bomber traffic just for pure air traffic management reasons. But also, He wants to extend the range of his aircraft. Daylight precision bombing depends on reaching into Germany with these mass formations we're going to talk about later. So he realises East Anglia is the place he needs to be. So although the first bombing air division is up here and around Northampton, and we see those triangles on the shape of the aircraft for them, really the centre of mass will become East Anglia, but that's not yet. We're here in 1942, in the summer of 42, and that's all yet to come. So that's why it's quite moving to be here on this day, this date, to talk about the very first raid.
And we call it the first raid, don't we? But there had been raids before this. This was the first American raid, but there had been Americans involved in bombing occupied Europe before this particular day. Explain that.
Yeah, you're right, because Ike, he's very, very important at this stage, and he's an Anglophile. He gets on really well with the Brits. He's a very quiet, taciturn Texan, and he's well-mannered, and he understands the British psyche, etc. So he forms a really close, almost symbiotic relationship with Bomber Harris and the Brits. And he says the British have given us everything we've asked for: accommodation, fuel, expertise, access to their secret equipment. And so he, part of that process is also getting his airmen, his guys who've never seen combat before and have no concept of fighting the Luftwaffe, into the air. And one of the things they do is put observers into British bombers with RAF crews to go on raids and experience what it's like. And from here at Grafton Underwood and Polbrook, that activity takes place. And it's not big Schweinfurt scale B-17 raids or B-24 raids. We're using Bostons, and the first raid, the first American air crew to fly into occupied airspace don't do it with a white star on their aircraft. They do it in RAF Boston light bombers. And that happens from here. So as early as the 29th of June 1942, Captain Charles Kegelman flew on a Boston raid into occupied France with 12 RAF Bostons who were bombing Hazebrouck. So he goes and experiences that, no incident. He comes back unscathed and thinks, OK, this is OK. And then later we progress to the 4th of July of all days, Independence Day, where the Americans take off with 6 borrowed Bostons and take place in a raid on Dutch airfields. They lose one. So one goes down in flames, so that's their debut, really. And Kegelman is wounded, and so one aircraft's missing in action. So that's a welcome to the realities of the air war over occupied Europe.
Quite literally a baptism by fire, almost.
Literally, yeah. It's interesting because that's a daylight raid. This is the RAF doing light daylight raids still in 1942, and the fighter sweeps are going on. So the war is changing, and the Americans have got this almost zealous belief in daylight precision bombing. They can't wait to get going, but they need the aircraft to do that, and that's going to be initially the B-17, Model E's and Model F's initially, and it'll be F's that fly from here.
So we're going to talk about the difference in strategies between the RAF and the United States Army Air Force a little bit later on. I mean, it's obviously symbolic, that 4th of July raid, chosen to be Independence Day. But they were under a lot of pressure to get things off the ground properly and do their own all-American-led mission using their own B-17 planes to show they were capable of doing it themselves and show the folks back home that they could be successful.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of politics, because there's internal politics in America between the US Army Air Force and the Army, because until earlier that year, they'd been the Army Air Corps and tightly controlled by the Army. Pearl Harbor does them a favor. It's like, okay, we're going to get into this bombing offensive game, and we need to be separate. We're going to be the Army Air Force, and we're going to do this away from the Army, although we'll still be technically part of the Army. And they need to prove that it works. And also, externally, Bomber Harris and Churchill have got their eyes on this new Air Force whenever it hasn't really arrived yet, but they've got their eyes on thinking the Americans are going to produce all these aircraft, and I think if they were to join the night offensive and alongside the RAF, we'll have real bombing power, and it will take the war to the Germans much faster. And Churchill, and particularly Harris and the rest of the RAF, Portal as well, the head of the Royal Air Force, they don't believe in daylight bombing. The RAF have tried it and lost big style over Germany in daylight. So they say, this is futile, this is a waste of resources, a waste of inexperienced aircrew. You really should just either help us with bombing submarine pens and chasing submarines out the Atlantic while you learn the ropes, or just invest in the night offensive. So Ike, Doolittle, Spatz, Hap Arnold, all these American commanders who are essentially, to varying degrees, disciples of Billy Mitchell and believe in this, have to prove it, and they have to prove it soon. So they're literally chomping at the bit to get this raid off the ground and to hit some German targets in daylight with the B-17, with the Norden bombsight, and say, hey, we can fight our way across occupied Europe through the air and we can do this. This is going to work.
So you said that this would be the middle of the runway, of the main runway from where the planes took off. There's a steady trickle of cars and people arriving, coming to see what it's all about. And if we look at the war memorial, there's a small wooden cross with the words, "We will never forget, in remembrance, Rouen, August 17, 1942. Also Schweinfurt and Regensburg, August 17, 1942. 43. The Schweinfurt and Regensburg missions we'll cover in a future podcast. But for now, Mike, I mean, it must have been quite something for the Americans to come here, completely different landscape to what they were used to back home.
Yeah, we tend to think of young Americans from Detroit or New York, but of course there were people from the Midwest who were farmers and people like that, who, some of them from New England, recognise the terrain or team, it feels familiar. But for many, it's just the standard of living. You know, they get all that indoctrination about how to behave around the British and how to not to brag, not to this, and you know, outside toilets are normal in the UK, this kind of thing. But you know, if you're here and you believe in what you're doing, it's a massive adventure. If you're air crew, you've probably flown here, you know, over the Atlantic. If you're ground crew, you've probably come on the Queen Mary or one of the cruise liners and into Scotland or Liverpool, and then come down by train. And then been picked up by road transport and brought here, usually at night, into the middle of nowhere. And if you're here at Grafton Undermud, as they called it, you know, the runways were too short initially. It had been built for lighter bombers. So when it's decided that there will be B-17s here, they decide they need to extend the runways. So a Taipei runway is, the main runway is 6,000 yards long. And the subsidiary runways are 4,500 and 3,000. So, and they form a triangular shape, as you know. So we're in the middle of what was the main runway. It's a huge undertaking. And it's UK PLC that foots the bill. The Americans pay a percentage of this, but it's part of the British rearmament process. And the design and actual construction, which is contracted out, is all done by British contractors. Later in the war, American engineers will become involved, certainly around where we've driven up from today, from Suffolk. You'd see a lot, or Norfolk, you'd see a lot of that. But initially, these pre-wartime airfields are a significant investment by the UK. And the Americans who arrive at Grafton Underwood, this is not a pre-war permanent airfield. A lot of the accommodation is wooden and canvas, wooden frame with canvas covers. This is, you know, even now in August, we're feeling the chill a bit with the rain, etc., and the extremes of weather. And we mentioned earlier about the June and July 4th raid. You know, these are all postponed due to rainy squalls, etc., which doesn't bode well when we get later on to talk about bombing, where if your whole doctrine is based around clear visibility, you know, suddenly you get here and you think, maybe it's not going to be that straightforward.
Well, straightforward it certainly wasn't. Everyone from that first Rouen raid returned safely to Grafton Underwood, but that wasn't always the case for the missions that followed. We're going to leave the airfield now and take a short drive to Grafton Underwood Village Church, the Church of St James the Apostle. And when we get there, we'll be able to discover some more about the people, the planes and the places of the Mighty Eighth.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you.
We've come to the village church at Grafton Underwood, the Church of St James the Apostle. It's a Gothic church, more than 700 years old, but there's a very special window here, a stained glass window designed by Brian Thomas in 1977. Mike, what are we looking at? Tell us about the window.
This, to me, is a physical evidence of this community viewing the presence of the Americans in a positive way and their contribution to the war. And if we look at it, it's three panels, multicoloured. I mean, the obvious centrepiece of it in glass is a B-17G, noticeably, because it's got the chin turret. And prominent in the right-hand pane is the tail plane of the aircraft with the triangular P for the 384th Bomb Group. So they were here the longest and they dominate the thinking of it. At the top, though, we can see right at the top in the centre, cross flags, Union flag and the Stars and Stripes, obviously, and then the squadrons 544th, 545th, 46th, 47th. So the emblems of the four squadrons that made up the 346th Bomb Group. And then the bomb group emblem is below the flags. And then we've got the B-17, which is really impressive. And it's a silver one, it's not the green. It's the later model, silver, all metal finish. It's the G model with the chin turret, as I said earlier. So that really epitomises the later stages of the war when the 384th would have been here doing their business. And across that, below the B-17, is a dedication. It says, "This window is dedicated before God in remembrance of those who gave their lives for freedom during World War II while serving at Grafton Underwood from 1942 to 1945, especially the members of the 384th Bomb Group, brackets heavy, of the United States 8th Air Force." And there is, interestingly, a Christian cross on the left and a Jewish Star of David on the right. And then below that, two doves and the phrase, "Coming home." So it really does dominate. As we walked in, we noticed there was the bomb group flag with some unit citations hanging in from the ceiling above us. And the prayer cushions have all got American and British military cap badges and emblems on them. And there's a brass plaque here explaining the glass window of St. James's Church. It says, "Dedicated May the 21st, 1983. So that's quite a way after the war, isn't it? Designed by John Mack of Savannah, Georgia, USA. Full-scale drawing by Brian Thomas, the studio in London, in England. So it's an Anglo-US project. And then the window's done by Peter Archer of King's Langley in England. But the critical thing, donated by the 384th Bomb Group, United States 8th Air Force, and the dedication is, that's the same dedication as on the grass about the window being dedicated to those who gave their lives at Grafton onwards. It's quite an impressive thing for such a small church, isn't it?
And you'd think that with at its peak, I guess 3,000 American airmen here in a small community of 100-150 people, you'd think that the community would be swamped. But what this is telling us is that villagers very much took the Americans to their hearts.
Yes, and they'd be here the whole time. We tend to think about this little village, and there are 60 B-17s. How long did it take us to get here by car? 3-4 minutes. So there are 60 B-17s, and they're not just taking off for raids. They're testing their engines, they're doing training flights, they're doing test flights, etc. There's road traffic coming in and out, they're doing resupply, bringing in fuel, bringing in spares, taking guys out to railway stations to go on leave in London or wherever they're going. So this would be, they'd be omnipresent by day and by night. And of course, we read about the partying and the GI brides and all, but there's more than that. You know, so many Americans were not that kind of person and would have come to church here on a Sunday. So it's such a church orientated society in parts, or some of the states of America, that this would have been quite busy with Americans coming to the church, using the local facilities. They'd have been everywhere, jeeps on the road, etc. So I think when they went, it must have been really strange. It must have been a really eerie silence after they'd left the airfield and gone back to the States.
You talk about jeeps, you talk about the B-17s, flying fortresses, high-tech pieces of equipment for their day. To have 60 of them here in an agricultural community where most people would be farming the land, still using literally horsepower rather than machinery, it must have been quite something, a real hive of activity.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the farming side of it, because so many of the 8th Air Force and 9th Air Force veteran accounts talk about guys who've been farmers back in the States, and in their downtime they go off and help with the harvest or work on the farms because they can work the equipment, they understand it, and not the entire American farming industry is not mechanized. They've still got horses, etc. They understand this. And one of those little details we tend to forget is most of these airfields have no fence. So they're porous. People can walk in and out of them. And older guys now who were school children at the time talk about, yeah, we used to go into the bomb dump. Yeah, we used to walk into the airfield. They'd go and see the guys working on the stands, etc., be adopted by them. They could go and get their gum and their chocolate, whatever they were doing, or just go and watch the aircraft. But to go back to your original point, this is cutting-edge technology. I mean, the B-17, you know, 1935 to where we are now, 1945, the evolution of that aircraft, those all those machine guns, the engines, the shiny aluminium and chrome all over it. I mean, it would be like something from another world. Yeah, and to see the big white star on it, etc., you know, they would occasionally see RAF heavy aircraft in daylight doing air tests, but Bomber Command is a literally a fly-by-night organisation, isn't it? So they you'd hear them go out to their targets and come, hopefully all come back. But the heartbeat of the village would be, I think, in synchronisation with the heartbeat of the station. It's just so close and so omnipresent.
And these airmen, and they would largely be men, late teens, early 20s, certainly the majority of them under 30.
Absolutely. And you hear, you read most of the accounts talk about the oldest man in the crew was 23 and we called him Pops or Grandpa. You know, and the average age for a gunner, you know, those who are working the gunners and the mechanics is 19. So it's a very young, and it's quite a turnover. We talk about 2,000 or 3,000 people on an airfield, but they're not all staying. Some of them aren't coming back. They're even shot down, taken prisoner, whatever, killed, posted elsewhere, moving around. It's quite a fluid, amorphous organisation with people coming and going all of the time.
So thousands of miles away from home then, people from all sorts of different backgrounds, from high-ranking officers to regular ground crew, air crew, and not all of them would come back.
No, many, many won't. I mean, as we'll talk about as we could go through the bomb run series, the attrition rate is staggering. You know, it's higher than the US Marine Corps in the island hopping campaign for the Air Force. It's equivalent to the US infantry. And when you read the Luftwaffe accounts and the US 8th Air Force accounts of the air battles from 42 to 45, it's almost got a great war feel to it, of a battle of attrition. You know, the Germans aren't being replaced. They're being taken out. They're taking down as many bombers as they can. The desperate battles up in the cold blue. It's almost Hollywood-style statements. We're all going to die. Just get used to it. Accept it and you'll be fine. You know, it really is on a par with the Great War. I mean, it's a different mentality to Bomber Command, who are going out not in a tight formation where they can see each other. They're fighting a very different war and their attrition rate is high. But these guys are fighting it. They see the enemy. They see it in daylight. And they've got that mission count all the time. Will I get to through the mission? Will I get to the next mission? And I'm getting nearer to going home, whether it's 25, 30 or 35 missions they need to do, depending on where they are in the war. So, yes, so many of them will not come home. I mean, don't physically get back. Some of those bombers that come back in here, the villagers will see them in the circuit. They'll see them firing flares to say they've got wounded on board. They'll hear the crashes. They'll hear the explosions. So they will experience the war as spectators of what's happening to this bomb group here, that their local bomb group.
The Rouen mission, they all came back safe except for a slight injury to a couple of aircrew when a couple of pigeons hit the plexiglass dome at the front of one of the B-17 bombers. And if we look at this window at the top, it says, keep the show on the road, bombs dropping from the sky. And at the bottom, where the two doves are, it says coming home. And it's about striking that balance, isn't it, between doing the job and also getting home safely.
Yes, it is. And American bombing doctrine is supposedly ethical. That's why they're going for precision bombing, because after the Versailles Treaty and the great waste, the carnage of the European War in 1418, that we won't do that. We're going to defend ourselves, defend our coastline with Norden bombsight, precision bombing. We'll hit the right target and we're not going to bomb cities. We're not going to bomb civilians. Ultimately, they'll have to, because that's the reality of the Second World War. But it really is phenomenal what they set out to achieve. And it just seems it's like stereotypical American. No fear. We can do that. You know, because this doctrine that they've got about daylight precision bombing and targeting, precision targeting, taking out particular railways or fuel or whatever they're doing. But they're gonna batter their way through with their fortresses and their liberators and in tight formation. It's a very different mentality, and you have to wonder Is that because they didn't suffer the way that everybody else did in the Great War? They're not averse to casualty loss, whereas the British and the Royal Air Force and the Army and the Royal Navy are, you know, are definitely in the steel not flesh frame of mind. Let's risk minimum life and let's not take casualties. And how much of it, as we'll find out as we go through the podcast series, is down to hanging on, clinging on to that doctrine and proving it, or is it valid? And, you know, keep the show on the road, yeah. Showing bombs is yeah, we'll fight our way through, we'll hit the target and we'll come back. And nobody's going to stop us. But it will be the right target. We're not going to bomb innocent civilians because that's counter to our perception of what war should be like in 39-45.
Let's go back to the airfield then and discuss the strategy behind these bombing raids, behind these missions, and look at why Rouen is such an important mission in World War II. You're listening to the Mighty Eight podcast with me, Johan Tasker, and military historian Mike Peters. We're at Grafton Underwood in Northamptonshire, Eastern England, where the first American-led mission set off to bomb occupied Europe during World War II. That very first all-American mission took place on August 17, 1942, and it targeted the railway marshalling yards at Rouen, northern France, in broad daylight. Now, we've returned to the airfield here at Grafton Underwood, walking along a concrete track to reach the operations room, the ops room, the briefing room. Now, the very first ops room at the airfield here, where the 97th Bomb Group who flew that mission were briefed before they set off, has long gone. The original building stood next to the airfield watchtower, or the control tower, demolished some years ago. And what we have here, what we're standing in front of, is its 1943 replacement. A flat-roofed brick building typical of the ops rooms on many World War II airfields. And it has to be said, it's in a sorry state. A shell of a building, if you like, covered in graffiti, decaying brickwork, surrounded by weeds, piles of rubble and mounds of earth. But it is, at least, still standing. Mike, the ops room was the nerve centre of the whole operation. And this derelict building still has very much a sense of place.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's certainly showing its age and it's been neglected for a long time, but the functionality of it is quite clear. It's, you know, the very few windows, the location on the airfield map, it's in that crossover point between the domestic site where people live, eat and sleep, and then get into the work site where the hard standings are, where the aircraft are, the transition from being in domestic site, going through the briefing cycle, preparing for a mission, climbing onto your aircraft and then taking off and off to your target and then coming back and then reverse, coming back through those briefing areas to debrief and tell the intelligence people what you've seen, how you've done against the target, where your bombs went, etc. And these buildings really are the linchpin of all of that planning and that command and control. And you know, this would be the building where the teleprinter would start tapping out the night before or even very early hours the morning before a mission and say the target for today is Berlin or Bremen or wherever it was going to be. And this would be the place where the lead navigator, the main operations officer for the bomb group would be and would start to build the plan to tell people what fuel load they need to put on each aircraft, how many aircraft, what crews, what formation, who's going to be where. This is the brain of the bomb group. This is before they leave, before they take off. All that choreography, orchestration, whatever you want to call it, it all emanates from here on different phone lines down to the squadrons, out to the flight line, out to the hard standings, the engineers, the caterers, even the provost, anybody. It all comes from here. And this is where the group commander will be with his close-in staff who make the decisions of how the mission will be shaped, how the mission will be flown.
The brains of the whole operation then.
Clearly, yeah. So it would come down from 8th Air Force headquarters into the bomb group, the warning order, or the executive order, as it's called, the field order. As you said, the army roots of the Army Air Force. It's the field, you get the field order, which is the operational instruction for the mission of, you know, where the target is, when you've got to hit it, what height you're going to bomb at, and all the rest. And then you work back from that, how much fuel you need, what type of bombs, when they need to be loaded, when the aircraft need to be online and ready to go, when they start their engines, because you can't be sat out on the runway running your engines for an extra hour. You're burning fuel you're going to need over the target and to get you back. So it's all worked out to the minute, hopefully, in theory. And of course, the thing we are going to talk about a lot in the whole series, the weather. the Met forecast is going to come into here. So that will decide whether it's on or off, whether you can see the target, because precision daylight bombing is difficult through cloud at the start of the war. And it will always be a factor. So the weather will be a huge factor in all of this.
And there were a couple of false starts before they finally got going on the 17th of August. Let's talk about the difference in strategies then between the British Royal Air Force and the US Army Air Force. The Americans, high altitude, precision bombing in daylight, whereas the RAF were bombing at night at a lower level and less precise.
Less precise, heavier bomb loads. You know, the Lancaster is the mainstay of the Bomber Command with the Halifax and the Stirling. You know, they were dropping much heavier loads of bombs over a wide reel. Let's be honest about that. But certainly, at the start of the war, the German Luftwaffe and the British Royal Air Force are both going to bomb in daylight. Everyone's like, we're going to bomb, we're going to hit the target. And there's some pretty wild claims about how accurate they can be. And then the reality of flying into opposed airspace, the weather, all of these other factors really hit home, particularly for the RAF. You know, the British bombers haven't got the armament that the B-17's got. They're carrying 303 machine guns rather than big, heavy 50 calibers. And they're not trained and to fly that way. They're not designed to fly in close formation. And in the end, we just haven't got the bomb sight to do what the Americans intend to do. So it rapidly becomes a matter of survival, maintaining a presence for the RAF. So, okay, we can bomb at night. As did the Luftwaffe at the end of the Battle of Britain. They switched to night blitzing because they couldn't survive against fighter command in contested airspace. The Americans come at it from a different perspective. Some might say a quite naive or simplistic view is, okay, we must precision bomb. We're going to spend a lot of money on the Norden bomb site so that we can hit the target. You know, the old euphemism about, yeah, you can drop it in a pickle barrel, you know. You can do that if you can see the target and you've got this bomb site, which is essentially a mini computer, which can calculate the drift and the bomb angle, etc. for you and set all that up. But they say, we're going to have to fight our way through there. In order to do that, we're going to have these combat boxes. We're going to fly in close formation. We're going to have interlocking arcs of fire between all of our aircraft, and we'll have so many machine guns that, you know, and a bomb group's got about 500 machine guns in a mass formation, that, and they're 50 calibre, they're heavyweight shells, they're not 303 like the RAF are using, that nobody is going to get near us. We don't need fighter escorts because the B-17 flies so high, so fast and so well armed. Its bomb load suffers correspondingly. The bomb load of a B-17 is equivalent to a light bomber. You've got a heavy bomber with a light bomb load. The Lancaster is a heavy bomber with an even heavier bomb load. So it's different philosophies about how to go about this. But when Eaker, Doolittle and Spatz and Hap Arnold and these people, you know, and I wouldn't call them a bomber mafia. I'd say they're believers in what they're doing to varying degrees. I mean, Spatz is quite critical of Billy Mitchell's philosophy along the way. But they all say, we can do this. We can do this in daylight. We have the technology, to use that phrase. So they arrive here with that in mind, and they're going to maintain that through the war. And don't get me wrong, there are times during the daylight campaign where it becomes, is this tenable and do we turn back? And later on we'll talk about fighter escort and all the difference that makes. But there's a dichotomy between the two. And certainly when they first arrive in UK, in England, Harris is saying, you really, really don't want to do this. You're going to lose a lot of aircraft. And of course, the RAF have tried to fly the Fortress with 90 Squadron and suffered quite badly, but they helped to identify a lot of the faults of flying at altitude, bad weather, the icing up of guns and all those other things that saved the 8th Air Force a lot of pain along the way, because they get all this back brief from the Royal Air Force crews who've flown the Fortress over Germany in small numbers. They've not really tried to do what the US Army Air Force believe in, this mass formation, these combat boxes. So in 42, everything seems possible. And that first raid from here, when they all come back, says, hey, what's the fuss about? You know, Yankee Doodle's gone to town. We've done it, because that's what the aircraft's called, you know. And Eaker's flown on the mission himself, and he's very keen to maintain close links with Bomber Command, but he doesn't want to get sucked into night bombing and being subordinate to them. The 8th Air Force is here to do its own thing in its own way.
And they wanted to show that that could be done. They had something to prove. And ostensibly, from their point of view, that Rouen mission proved that they could do it.
Yeah, I mean, the initial plan, they're quite realistic in their initial thoughts, is we need to be battlefield inoculator. We need to fly some missions with the RAF. You know, don't forget the what will become the fighter groups. They can't fly the P-39 Air Cobra. It's not good enough. They've got some P-38 Lightnings, but they're being equipped with Spitfire Mark 5s, and they're flying with the RAF. And Fighter Command are actually controlling the US Army Air Force fighter groups at this point in the war, the early start of the war. They're taking part in that. And the edict is that we will commence daylight bombing operations within the range of RAF Fighter Command escort. That's the start. It'll go beyond that very quickly, but the start is, okay, let's build up some flying hours, let's build up our credibility, let's learn some lessons, let's go through the whole cycle of what fuel to use, what bombs to use, how to fly, how to form it. Because, you know, corralling all those aircraft and getting them all together in daylight, it might sound easy in daylight, but this is English daylight with cloud bases and weather changes, etc., and the same over the target. So they've got a lot to learn. They've done a lot of long navigational exercises across the United States and all that kind of thing. This is a whole different ballgame. This is, as the American press call it, this is the big league.
So one of the pilots of the lead plane on this Rouen mission, Paul W. Tibbetts, he's something of a poster boy for the US Air Force.
Yeah, he is, because Tibbetts, as most people know, will go on to fly the Enola Gay and drop the first atom bomb. So he's got a remarkable record. I mean, if you track back to all of these prominent people at the start of the US Army Air Force experience here in Europe, we've mentioned Eaker, we've mentioned Spatz, we've mentioned Doolittle. These are the high rankers, but also Castle, Armstrong, people like that who come across, they come across as captains. And if you're going to grow an Air Force up to 60 groups in strength, you've got to find the experience from somewhere. So people are going to be pulled through and promoted very quickly. And Paul Tibbetts, he comes across, he's on that first raid, he's flying a Boston bomber, and he's been one of these pioneering pilots back in the States. So they're called Eaker's amateurs because he also commissioned a lot of civilians who are experts in logistics and administration and all this. But, you know, America comes into the war late, as we know, but it's not unexpected. You know, even 1942, they've got about 245,000 personnel across the air forces, 23,000 aircraft in existence. They're not all good aircraft. And it's interesting, when you get to the end of the war, they've got 2.4 million personnel and 24,000 aircraft. So the number of aircraft hasn't changed much. The quality has changed. And that expansion in numbers is logistics, technicians, backup planning, etc. So if you're someone like Tibbetts and you start the war as a captain, you're going to get promoted. If you're good at what you do and you survive, you're going to get promoted. Eisenhower is a great example himself. And he starts the war as a colonel, finishes as a five-star general. So if you're going to grow and expand that quickly, anyone who's competent, anyone who can do what they're supposed to do and do it thoroughly and properly is going to get promoted.
And there's something of symmetry then about Grafton Underwood. We saw earlier on from the war memorial that the first and the last bombs dropped by the 8th Air Force were dropped by planes that flew from here. Yeah. And then you've got the whole American involvement in the air war is bookended by Paul Tibbetts, who pilots the plane that drops the first bombs on that Rouen mission, but also right at the end of the war, he pilots the plane that drops the atom bomb on Hiroshima.
And because of Hiroshima, he's singled out for that. But there are other people who do the whole, I hate to use the word journey, but survive the whole war, you know, all those years of combat, and people who do their complete number of missions and volunteer for more and come back, you know, or transfer to fighters or whatever. And you know, let's not forget that there are so many bomb groups. They start off with a target of 60 groups, and 35 of them will be heavy bomb groups. But there's going to be 16 American air forces across the world. Not one, not two, but 16 different air forces across the world. It's a massive expansion.
A massive expansion. And as Paul Tibbetts said in his autobiography, in the 995 days of air war against Germany that followed, the 8th Air Force would drop almost 4.5 million bombs on Europe, plus more than 25 million incendiaries. It came at a huge cost, though. The 8th would lose more than 40,000 bomber crewmen killed or missing, and an additional almost 2,000 very seriously wounded. What we're going to do in this series, Mike, is look at, was it worth it? How did it work? What was the cost? What was the benefit? And the stories of the people involved.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that because, you know, it's a significant contribution to the outcome of the war. And it's a remarkable story, and it doesn't take anything away from the other aspects of the war. Everyone played their part. But the 8th Air Force is just a fascinating story.
A fascinating story, Mike. Indeed, many, many fascinating stories. Look, it's been an absolutely amazing visit to Grafton Underwood, visiting the exact same place where it all started on August 17th, 1942. But for now, that's about it for this episode of the Mighty Eighth podcast. Before we go, though, please do subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please, if you can, leave us a 5-star review. It'll make the Mighty Eighth podcast easier for other people to find, and it'll help us reach more listeners. We've got lots more episodes in the pipeline, lots more fascinating and remarkable stories about the Mighty Eighth. But for now, for military historian Mike Peters and me, Johan Tasker, thank you for listening, and do please join us again next time as we continue to discover the people, the planes, and the places of the United States 8th Army Air Force.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.